history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, do we add to our understanding. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend marks Independence Day and the 244th anniversary of the moment when John Hancock signed that document that would change the course of history. A month later, 55 others added their signatures in support of the Declaration of Independence. With a firm reliance on divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, they said. In short, they risked everything they had for an experiment in support of what they called self-evident truths, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That sentiment, expressed 244 years ago, remains the central ideal of America. It was not applied perfectly then, and recent events remind us it isn't perfect now either. And 75 years ago, there were some pretty clear inconsistencies, but when held up to the light against the despotic machine of Nazi Germany and the merciless advance of Imperial Japan, the ideals of America were worth fighting for, even when it came to people who had not received the fully matured promise of the Declaration's equality. Today we're going to hear the memories of three World War II veterans, one Caucasian, one African American, and one Japanese American. We're going to hear what they were facing 75 years ago in July of 1945. And by the end of this hour, their perspectives may have had an impact on your perspective, both about World War II and with regard to the state of our Union today. First, let's listen to Patch Curtis, who at this time 75 years ago was still trying to recover from injuries he'd suffered 4 months earlier with the 1st Cavalry Division in the push to liberate Antipolo on the Philippine island of Luzon.
The first thing that happened, an A-20A attack plane, was a smoke started, and they just laid a smoke screen 10 miles across the face of that mountain. They had 4.2 chemical mortars set up in intervals all down through that 10-mile section, firing red smoke shells. And as these red shells would go up, they were spaced apart. Each unit was supposed to stay in that line that was delineated by these smoke lines. So when they made the blackout, these red lines started up and we were given the order to go. So we went ahead. Now, our particular assignment that day was to take a artillery observation unit from a 155-millimeter howitzer battery and place them on their optimum observation point. We were supposed to escort them up and get them put down on the place where they were supposed to direct the fire from their battery. I had been on patrol in that day before and was most familiar with the area that they wanted to go traverse, so I was appointed point. So we started out at 8 o'clock up through the smoke screen after the massive artillery barrage went off ahead of us, and as we went up, the ground was filled with craters 12 to 18 inches deep. Ground looked like it had just been plowed with these shells, but we went on up, and when I say up, it was the base of a mountain, and as you went further up, it got steeper and steeper and steeper. Sure. We were pretty successful and didn't receive too much resistance, and only a couple of firefights on the way up. Till about 11 o'clock, we got up down a particular area. We ran into some resistance. The unit commander decided the best way to subdue the Japanese was we had a bazooka section that would fire bazooka shells, a 60-millimeter mortar section, and so they fired up all the bazooka shells. The Japs still continued to fire back at us. All of the mortar shells got used up trying to knock them out, so there weren't any more mortar shells available. So finally, platoon sergeant said to me, Curtis, take your squad down and see if you can knock them out with grenades. We were up on the lee side of a hill where they couldn't get to us, so I went down the backside and around, and it was kind of an open swale down and a hill up on the backside over here, and I went around. I made sure all of them had four grenades and full belt of ammo and so on. Well, I started out with them down and went around and headed around here, and I said, let's pick up the pace. We don't want to be standing around too slow and make a good target. And so we started kind of moving a little faster, and we were firing as we were advancing. And one of my guys stumbled and went down, and as he went down, he almost hit me. He was pulling off shots as he fell down, and I turned and said, you almost hit me. Get up. And he was down on his hands and knees like this. I kicked him in the behind, and he greatest started to get up and so on. And by then, the first bullet hit me over on the left shoulder here, and I figured, well, we were stopped. We were in wide open space, and we're not moving anymore. We're dead meat. So I started to turn to say, let's get out of here. And that's when the bullet hit me in the chest here.
What did that feel like?
It knocked the breath out of me, and I went down on my back. It spun me around. I couldn't get my breath. A fleeting thought went through, well, I guess this is it. But for some reason, I got my breath a little bit. Somehow I got initial shock. I guess my heart stopped or something, too. I don't know. But anyway, a guy grabbed me by one leg and pulled me back around this point of this little hill and so on. I don't know how they got me back up on the top of the hill in the back. I was unconscious by then. I woke up. I remember the aid man was working on me, and they were giving me some morphine. And I remember when I'd breathe, it was going like that, and I had tried to get my hand over here to close it up.
So you could tell that your lung was punctured?
Well, I didn't know. It just hurt, and I couldn't get my heart to get my breath. I was real short of breath, and I was coughing a little bit, and I was in and out after that. But when one incident, I woke up, and my fellow squad leader, a fellow by the name, my last name was Carmona, he had me in his lap, and the aid man had told him to keep my shoulder up so I wouldn't drown in my own blood. So he was kind of holding me up in his lap. And I heard, for Christ's sake, Carmona, take your carbine and shoot me. I can't stand this pain. He says, well, I'll get the aid man to give you some more morphine. And the aid man, Andy Anderson, he said, I can't give you any more. It'll stop your breathing. So I said to Carmona, take your carbine and shoot me. I can't stand this pain. So that was about 11 o'clock in the morning, as they later on they were able to kind of tell me. That went on all the rest of that day. They wanted to get a stretcher party up, but the Japanese had moved in on the trail behind, and they couldn't bring anybody here. No ammunition or anything. They couldn't get anything up to us. They were still in radio communication with the rear, but they couldn't make physical contact because the Japanese had intervened. And they decided that maybe after dark they could circumvent the Japanese. So sometime after dark, they got a stretcher party up there to get me in. And they had took six guys on the stretcher to get me down off of there. So I didn't get down to the 1st Medical Squadron Station till somewhere around midnight. And I remember one instance on the stretcher on the way down. I was in and out all the time. But one instance, a problem that I got kind of aroused. They couldn't figure out how to get me down off this level, but somehow they did. They laid us out in the yard before they finally got me into a surgeon, and all I can remember, somebody woke me up enough to say that I was getting my first blood transfusion. They showed me the name on the bottle there, and they read it off to me. Gaeus, G-A-Y-E-O-U-S. Gately, G-A-T-E-L-E-Y. Anyway, that was the first blood transfusion that I got.
And what all did they have to do surgically for you?
They didn't really do much except took out quite a few pieces. They reconstructed, later on they told me, what apparently had happened. I had a pair of binoculars on, and the bullet hit the binoculars first and disintegrated partially. So in the stuff that they took out of me was the pieces of binocular castings, piece of glass, leather from my wallet that was in my chest pocket here, piece of paper from stuff that was in the wallet, bullet fragments, and some of the bullet fragments they wrapped up. Here's the dog tags. That's all I got back with.
You were wearing these?
That's what I had on at the time.
You had this dog tag on at the time, and you've saved it with the leather strap.
And it's still blood-soaked, and that shoestring is still soaked with my blood.
Wow.
And they were finding all that stuff in me, so apparently the bullet fragment, there's one large piece that's about as big as my thumbnail still down underneath there, and with that adhesive tape that's wrapped around them there that you see, they had a piece of the bullet fragments that they had found in the outer layers of skin there. All those pieces of stuff that you see shattered through there,
yeah,
that's a good part of that is binocular.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't, the binocular hadn't been on there, it's very likely the bullet would have gone through much cleaner.
And not spread out so much debris in there.
Yeah.
And they had to take out a couple of your ribs?
Yeah, that happened a year and some months after. These two ribs that they took out wouldn't heal. They developed osteomyelitis, and they were getting worse and worse.
But basically, the whole right side of your chest
is
crushed, destroyed, bruised.
Right.
Your lung was damaged.
Right. The first operation, they didn't think there was anything in the lung. It was collapsed. And when the lung collapses, apparently a hard coating forms on there, and they have to strip all that. They called it a decortication operation. They stripped that off before the lung can re-expand. Apparently they did that, but apparently there was still stuff in there because in January of 1946, I started coughing up blood. They couldn't figure out what that was, but they took a lot of pictures and stuff in there. Again, the Veteran Administration was completely overwhelmed. They couldn't find a bed to put me in. They wanted to send me up to some hospital up way up in Oregon, and I didn't want to go up there because I didn't know anybody. I had the job down there that I thought I would, because I went back to work on January the 1st.
Well, wait a second, though. You went back to work, but I know that one of the other effects of that injury, at least in the immediate aftermath, was you really didn't have the use of your right arm, right?
Yeah, right.
What, what kind of state were you in for the next few weeks after you got hit?
Initial medical help.
Yeah.
I was transferred to the 41st Field Hospital in Quezon City. That was a place to get your feet back underneath of you and get a little weight going back and so forth. And I was there for several weeks. They moved us down on the docks in Manila and put us on a hospital ship for a general hospital down in New Guinea, back at Hollandia. I was on this hospital ship on April the 10th, my birthday, on the 12th of April, and the day that President Roosevelt died, that came in over the radio, that President Roosevelt, and then I wound up down in this 54th General Hospital in Hollandia for quite a while. That's where my arm wasn't working.
And when you say it wasn't working, you had no control of it all or no strength?
It was cold. I couldn't lift it. I could feel some. I could move my fingers and so on, but I couldn't do anything with them.
Because there was muscle damage from the shot you received.
And they also said there was probably some nerve damage,
sure,
which disappeared. That problem disappeared later on.
I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this and they're thinking, well, how long did it take them to recover? And that's probably not a simple question, because in some ways you probably never recovered.
Yeah, that's right. I'm short 50% of my normal air.
And the other thing I've got to say, I don't want to be melodramatic, but we talked about your four kids and 13 grandkids and 30 great-grandkids. And after hearing your story, it sure seems like it's a miracle that any of them were ever born, because most people wouldn't have survived what you went through, and it sounds like it took a lot of help from a lot of other people to save your life.
That's absolutely true. I've had help all of my life. And that's another thing I marvel at. My grandmother picked me up after my mother died. My friends in San Francisco picked me up after I lost my place on the ranch. On and on and on and on.
And those guys had to drag you out of the spot where you got hit.
Yeah.
And they're risking their own lives in doing so.
Absolutely. All the way. And all the other people down the line that I ever had anything to do with. And you, now here, you're helping me spread the word, which is something I believe in. We need a lot of improvement in our patriotism in this country. We are in a wonderful country that we live in, and you only have to see the results of occupation like occurred in the Philippines that other countries do to you, and what it might have been like had they been successful in doing that to us, including the Japanese and the Germans.
For those of us who weren't alive during World War II, who didn't see any of this, who didn't understand what could have been and what almost was, what do you think we need to know about you and all the guys like you who risked their lives for our country?
I would like to hope that we could all be aware of what it took, of what it was and what they did, and order their lives accordingly, and also somehow gather the feeling that they too could make a contribution like that if they were called on to do that.
You've made it very clear how close you came to not coming home, to adding to that number of over 400,000 Americans who died in World War II. How often over the years have you thought about some of those guys you knew who didn't come home?
Almost every day. For example, this Carmona that I mentioned, he lies in the Roswell Cemetery. He was given a Silver Star for his action the next day after I was wounded in killing the Japanese that stopped me. The other one that I turned up, I mentioned earlier that I stepped aside to let my BAR man shoot this first Japanese. He received a Distinguished Service Cross for his actions on March the 9th, along with Carmona, and subduing the Japanese strong point.
And am I understanding that they were both killed that day?
They were both killed. They were both awarded their awards of Silver Star and Distinguished Service Cross posthumously.
And with Carmona, people remember, you're saying he was killed the day after you were hit. But what you shared with us is that he was one of those who helped save your life by cradling you and holding you upright so you didn't drown in your own blood.
Absolutely. And a day later, he was dead. So I forever have a debt to him. I think about some of this stuff every day.
That was Patch Curtis of the 1st Cavalry Division. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. As he was recovering from the injuries he suffered on Luzon, the next vet you'll hear from was on his way to that island. And he had already gone through being declared an enemy by the very country where he was born. Hear that explanation when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.